Armed Luminous by Carl Phillips. About sacrifice, I am not so sure now. A river falls or rises according to what leaves or enters it. But sacrifice is not the river. Compassion is not what leaves. For what enters, I have many names. I'd decide if I could, if I were meant to. There's an instinct that is rare but does occur in humans, the ones who themselves feel no different. It's any hour, forgettable, as they turn toward the work whose power will break them eventually and make their name. I turn everywhere. I see the shapes by which a holiness declares itself more and more, as if to be noticed were all it wants of me. The body, for example, in a cloud of mayflies stalled briefly in a light that passes, now the moon, now the stars appearing, choir-like, with a choir's tendency to make the soloist at once seem lonelier and more complete. I'm not reckless. I'd comply if I could. In dream, there's a choice. Precious freight, or the barge that carries it, or the water without which a barge can at first seem nothing. I choose the water. I choose with a wisdom that looks effortless because it is. It's that kind of dream.
Welcome to Poets Cafe. Our very special guest today is Pam Houston. She's visiting us from all over the world and from her ranch in Colorado. She's the author of Cowboys Are My Weakness, which has been translated into 9 languages, and in addition to winning the Western States Book Award, was named a New York Times Notable Book. Her stories have been selected for volumes of Best American Short Stories, the O. Henry Awards, the Pushcart Prize, and Best American Short Stories of the Century. She's the winner of the Willer Award for Contemporary Fiction. And her other books include Sighthound, A Little More About Me, Waltzing the Cat, and her latest work, Contents May Have Shifted, out now on Norton. Let's talk a minute about the poem you opened up with. I just wanted to quote something that was said about Carl Phillips because it was so eloquently, beautifully articulated by the judge for the Griffin Poetry Prize. He said, Carl Phillips is a poet of both the line and the sentence, rubbing these two intangible structures, one musical, the other linguistic, against one another in an ancient way of kindling verbal and intellectual fire. And Phillips does that poem after poem. You chose to open your most recent work, Contents May Have Shifted, with an excerpt from that poem, the beautiful poem you read at the opening. First of all, welcome, Pam.
Thank you.
And what is it about Carl's work that speaks to you?
Well, it's many things at one time. For the purposes of this book and the line I chose, it's that reaching after something to believe in that's always there, that's always in his work. Reaching after it and missing, or reaching after it and trying again, and being self-conscious in your own pursuit of belief. It's all those things wrapped up in that poem in particular, and other poems. I say often, and I believe that Carl Phillips is the greatest living poet. I think, and I think what you read about him is very well articulated. It's when you hear him read his work, and I will say that reading that poem on the air was one of the scariest things I've done lately, because I revere his work so much.
You did a perfect job.
Thank you. But listening to him read it and listening to the way those sentences are, you know, both musical, but also the pausing and the doubling back and all of that is so full of meaning. It so informs the poem, you know, way the lines are interrupted and then not, and then more fluid than a line ought to be able to be, and then interrupted again, and that constant self-questioning and self-consciousness, but not, it's not precious ever. It feels so authentic, you know, that wanting to declare and being afraid to declare, just the way all that stuff shows up in every poem. And that poem is from a book called Writing Westward, which is really my favorite book of poetry.
I cannot thank you enough for turning me on to Carl Phillips.
Yeah.
I feel it's one of those poets, you know, once in a while somebody comes your way and it completely excites you. It's like an ecstatic experience,
yeah,
you know,
right.
because you go, oh my God, where have I been?
Right,
don't know this guy. It's
right.
beautiful. And I'm just reading poem after poem. And I find myself saying, I just, you know, I don't want to do anything else. I just want to, right?
Yeah.
I just want to get lost in this world.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful way to open a book of quest and experience and incredible profoundness, too. Even though, you know, there's a lot of levity in the book. Since we're on the Poets Cafe, I want to kind of jumpstart us, as we have been, with poetry. You have a connection to poetry. You know Kwame Dawes and Mark Doty.
I do.
And do they help give you a sense of freedom in your writing? I mean, how does poetry help inform your work?
Well, there's so many answers to that question.
Yes.
the first one is that I went to the University of Utah. I got my, I almost got my PhD at the University of Utah, all but the very last little bit. And so I spent my formative years as a writer there. And I was there at the time that Mark Strand and Larry Levis were there.
Lucky you.
And I didn't, I mean, one of my big regrets is that I was too afraid to take a poetry class. And yet I worked with Larry on Western Humanities Review.
Mm.
I worked with Mark on the Visiting Writer Series.
Mm.
I heard them read multiple times. I heard all the poets they brought to campus read. So, you know, the fiction program, honestly, at Utah was like in parentheses at that time. And
mm-hmm.
everything was about the poets. And it was such a rich and heady time to be a graduate student there. And my friends were poets, the other writers in the program, and they're still my friends. And, you know, I'm not a poet. You know, I know that I'm not, and I don't exactly long to be. Every now and then I'll write a poem. I will write a poem, and then I'll sort of come to my senses and turn it into the first paragraph of something, which
okay.
it usually works much better as.
Mm.
And I understand the line when I read it. I don't exactly understand it when I'm writing. You know, I wasn't trained as a poet.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, this book, Contents May Have Shifted, much more than any of the others, is really an expression of my love of poetry. It, you know, it's not a book of poems, but it is assembled like a poem. It is, it gathers its meaning associatively rather than chronologically or logically. It really is, it's me saying, you know, I love poetry. That's one of the things this book is saying. And so for that reason as well, I wanted Carl, my favorite poet, at the front of the book. You know, some reviewers have said that these are prose poems, 144 prose poems that make this up.
But isn't that a compliment?
It is such a compliment.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, there is nothing that has made me happier that has happened to this book than when a poet friend of mine writes me a letter. David St. John, who I know, you probably know, who
lives
sure. here.
We love him.
Yes.
Yeah.
He wrote me the loveliest email when this book came out, and there's nothing that I would rather be than praised for this book by a poet. And that shows you, you know, how serious I am about how much I revere and respect poetry and how much I want my language to work as hard as a poet's language works, and how influential those poets in Utah and my cohort, as well as the poets who were teaching there, influenced me as a writer.
Mm. All your work begins in the physical world, and much like a poet, in the sense that I think you're tuning in, you're looking for some flicker
mm-hmm.
that lights you up, that impresses you or inspires you. And I noticed that there's the metaphor of water is mm-hmm. often runs through your work, and it was even evident in the beautiful poem by Carl.
Right.
Something in the physical world. And so water is the deep metaphor that runs through and how it changes and reflects and also how it threatens
mm-hmm.
in a way. In your work beginning in the physical world, you're something out that you notice. It could be a reflection of water. So there's a similarity in terms of poetic inspiration and fiction writing.
I guess that's right. You know, I often say when I'm teaching, you know, prose writers, I often find myself saying, well, I don't think about a character, and I don't think about a plot, and I don't think about a story. Eventually, in revision, I think about narrative arc,
right,
or lack of it, purposeful lack of it. But no, everything I write begins by something that I notice, something I call them glimmers rather than flickers, but something that glimmers out there and grabs my attention and pulls me over there. And I think of my early writing process, meaning early in a project, as going out in the world, looking, paying really strict attention, looking for those things, picking them up, bringing them home, turning them into language, and then letting them sit next to each other and see what they do together. And that's often the way poems get made, I realize. But I don't ever think, oh, I have an idea for a character, or maybe I should write the story of X, Y, or Z. I don't ever think that. I collect glimmers until there's a critical mass of them.
That's amazing.
And then I start letting them talk to each other.
So then the characters come afterwards, in other words. They're sort of, are they written to the...
Well, you know, my work is very autobiographical, so there's always a character.
Right.
There is often, or most always, a character that is me in there somewhere.
It's you know, we're talking often about the experiential.
Right.
And I know you've said somewhere that 86%
right.
is you,
right.
you know. And of course, as a reader, you can't help but think,
right.
how much of this is true?
Right.
But that's the wonderful part about it, you know, that's part of the mystery.
And that's, you know, that's a poetic impulse, too. I mean, really, if you think about it. I mean, I'm really just thinking about it in those terms at this moment. But you know, people don't spend a lot of time, at least not intelligent readers, don't spend a lot of time saying to poets, oh, did this really happen to you? You know, it's not a question.
Right.
And that's a question that I get every single time, you know, I'm on stage anywhere doing anything, which is fine. I'm happy to answer that question. But but to me, right. I'm just doing what seems like I'm not intentionally being autobiographical. Mm-hmm. I'm simply following my process. It's
right.
like, that's what you do. You pay really strict attention out in the physical world. You bring home the things that, you know, when I have that feeling, when I have that glimmer feeling, you know, it's almost like a vibration.
It's similar in poetry.
Yeah, it's this sense that, okay, that thing in the exterior landscape is going to help me excavate something in the interior landscape. That's mine.
Mm-hmm.
I get to bring it home. And sometimes it's ugly and sometimes it's pretty, and you know, often it's layered, you know, there's whatever it is on the surface is not what it is underneath, and I bring it home and I let it sit next to other things that have had that vibration and eventually they start to distill, you know, whatever the story is starts to distill up out of them, you know, like spirits, like Jack Daniels.
Yeah. and that in a sense keeps the muse sort of always.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well,
in that sense.
I never like to know, you know, like I don't like to know what I'm
right.
doing, you know, that I never want to know too early what I'm doing.
And going to these places, I'm going to name a few that you've been: Alaska, Tibet, Tunisia, New Jersey, of course that's where you're from, and the Kingdom of Bhutan, which is so very exotic. I think you've probably been all over the world by now. Your view of humanity must have been altered in profound ways through these experiences.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it was most altered. You mentioned Bhutan. I've been to Bhutan twice, and the first time I went was very soon after the country opened up. So when I went there the first time, it was my first trip to Asia. It was my first time in a Buddhist country. It was my first time in the Himalayas. And I was one of the first people who went into Bhutan.
Amazing.
I mean, you know, by a few hundred or something.
Yeah, sure.
And so it was, you know, Shangri-La. I mean, it was a completely untouched place. With the king, you know, who believes in gross national happiness and all of that. You know, we've read about him now a lot. But it was unbelievable that a place like that could exist to me. And it was so other, you know, and I've always been attracted to the other.
Yes.
And it was so other. And it changed everything about the way I thought. I mean, I think I was probably leaning that way. But, you know, like from New Jersey, from Trenton, New Jersey, to like you know, a sort of Buddhist compassion, yeah. you know, is yes. a long old way. Yes. And that was a giant step for me. I mean, I always say now, you know, I say, well, I would like to be a Buddhist. I can't be a Buddhist because when you're from New Jersey, you're really attached. And it's true. You know, I'm very mm-hmm. attached. But everything I learned from my guide that first trip to Bhutan, his name was Karma, unbelievably, but true.
Wow.
His name was Karma. He was a very young man. He was 18, I think. And just being in his presence for 28 days, you know, was enough to change my life. I mean, he was living, you know, all those things that we're always reaching for in this country, you know. And you know, it's easy to romanticize all that. And I know about that. But it was completely life-changing because Bhutan brought everything together. Like, it brought together a religious practice that made sense with the most spectacular natural place I had ever been. I walked for 18 days, you know, over 17,000-foot passes. I mean, plus just this idea of a country and a king who, I mean, it's no joke. Like,
right.
he believes in gross national happiness. and he yeah. wouldn't let his people vote until he taught them to read, you know. And so then he taught mm-hmm. them to read so they could convert to democracy, which most of them didn't want. Mm-hmm. You know, they wanted to be under the protection of this.
Were you tempted to live there?
Oh, it's hard to live there. No, but I was tempted to return to Asia again and again.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, tried to bring enough of it back with me in my heart, you know, so that I don't ever forget. And there is a way that I do feel like it's my place. I went back to Tibet several years after I went to Bhutan. And when I got off the plane, I just kept saying, I couldn't stop saying it. I'm so happy to be here. I'm so happy to be here. So there's some past life thing, or there's something for me and Bhutan that is, or the Himalayas, mm-hmm. the Himalayan region, which is very, very powerful.
It's interesting that you say you're attached and you couldn't let, you know, because of the Buddhist
yeah, yeah.
and this, but at the same time, you're so very open.
Yeah.
You're open to experience. And I had this realization when I was reading your work, of this connection between, because you love authenticity, and I do too. I think we all do, and we admire people that can completely be themselves. And I thought about that, and I thought, well, what is it? What is this the other side of that? And it's sort of fear, you know. So going for your authenticity helps kind of set aside these fears and just makes you be bolder and go out there.
That's true. And when I say I'm attached, I mean, what do I mean by that? You know, I'm attached, you know, what the Buddhists say all the time when you're there is, you know, they'll tell you some terrible thing that happened to someone and you'll think, oh God, that's awful. And they'll say, oh, but you know, this life, it's nothing.
Yeah. Right.
And that's the part that I can't get to. Cause like to me, this life, it's something, you know, it's something.
And
I love it, you know, so much. And I don't love it in a simple way. I mean, I had a rough start, you know, but I feel, you know, attached to the sky and attached to the mountains and attached to the ocean. And, you know, like so many of us, you know, I feel it physically when it gets hurt, you know, when it gets destroyed, and all the recent frightening things that have happened in the recent election. And, you know, I mean, I feel so, like, I can't say, oh, well, you know, in my next life, you know, or in the next ocean or on the next planet, you know. I mean, that's the way I think I'm mostly attached. I'm environmentally attached.
But at the same time, that's important because we can't remove our own responsibility.
Right.
And
sure.
so keeping that intensity and awareness is vital,
right.
you know, to caring,
right.
I think.
Right.
You have an excerpt.
Oh, yeah.
Which you would like to read? Because we want to hear more from your book, and then we can continue on.
This is the book is in 144 very short chapters. Each chapter is named with the place that little mini chapter occurs. And this one is called Istanbul, Turkey. Istanbul, Turkey. At the Sultan's palace, beautiful long-limbed girl, sexy but not too sexy, lots of brassy hair, surrounded by 7 or 8 international travelers her age. To an Australian boy with acne scars, she says, "You are walking through the Topkapi Palace with 3 beautiful women. What more do you want?" The other young women are not in the same room of beautiful as she, but they accept the compliment. Don't dare to interrupt. The boy says, "Maybe if you were all naked," and laughs. One of the other girls, a Swede, says, "No," meaning, "Go kick yourself, acne face." The brassy-haired girl holds her fingers to the Swede's lips, says, "My parents taught me never to say no immediately." "To men?" the Swede asks. "To anything," she says. Istanbul is the only major city in the world that is situated on 2 continents. Since 330 AD, it has been the capital of the Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, the Latin Empire, and as recently as 1922, the Ottoman Empire. In the hilly streets, ruin leans into palace, leans into internet cafe. We are in line waiting to get into the harem. Miles of tiled, low-lit corridors and rooms so thick with ghosts of women in captivity, you can feel their hair on your arm, their jasmine-scented breath on your face. In the Blue Mosque, there are 250,000 tiles the color of sky. When the sun comes out, inside is sky and outside is golden. I am 46 years old and ashamed of the fact that this is the first mosque of my life, but later, when the evening call to prayer catches me in the garden between the Blue Mosque and the Hagia Sophia, call and echo, echo and answer, bouncing off domes and turrets that have stood on this hill for 1,500 years, I know faith springs out of doubt like topsoil, and one thing I am is here right now. Across the Golden Horn, where the Bosphorus meets the Sea of Marmara, the Asian part of the city glistens in the twilight. As a candidate for the center of everything, Istanbul beats Pueblo, Colorado, hands down. The gulls are turning cartwheels around the towers of the Blue Mosque and calling like crazy women. "Byzantium," I say to them. "Constantinople." The circle of my now is wreaking havoc with the lines of my doing. I am learning to say yes, if not always immediately. A sweet-faced Turkish boy, maybe 19, offers me a Kleenex, puts both hands over his heart when I take it, says I look just like his mother when I cry.
Beautiful, thank you. If you're just tuning in, we're here with Pam Houston, who's visiting us from all over the world, including Istanbul. And we're here on KPFK 90.7 FM, and this is Poets Cafe. This is an incredible excerpt and a demonstration of your lyrical sensibility that can be found throughout this beautiful book, Contents May Have Shifted. As the director of the Creative Writing Program and at UC Davis and also the Pacific University Low Residency MFA Program, do you think it's important in a creative writing program for poets to be exposed to poetry? Do you include that yourself, or do you keep that in a separate?
You mean part? Fiction writers?
Uh-huh, fiction writers.
I absolutely do. In fact, when I'm no longer director at UC Davis, but I was for many years.
Okay.
And I teach.
Scratch that.
That's right. I was for too long. I was for about 13 years, and I just recently stopped.
Okay.
But one of the first things I did as director was make a cross-genre workshop mandatory.
Oh, great.
So
yeah.
We occasionally do teach nonfiction, but we're mostly a fiction poetry program. So mm-hmm. What that meant, of course, was that the poets had to take fiction and the fiction writers had to take poetry. And I did it, among other reasons, to make the workshop better mm-hmm. for me, you know, mm-hmm. because if you get 3 or 4 poets in a fiction workshop, everybody starts to pay more attention to how they're using language,
that's
you know.
Right. That's
and language
true.
Stops being a dump truck to convey meaning and or a conveyor belt and starts, you know, poets in a classroom will make the fiction writers more aware of how they're using language, I find.
Yes.
I'm not sure of the benefit for the poets, but there probably is some.
Okay.
There probably is some. And so, yeah, it matters to me a lot that my graduate students read poetry, my pro students read poetry, and I always assign it. And when I teach at Pacific, I am helping those prose writing students of both fiction and nonfiction to assemble a reading list each quarter of 20 or 25 books, and I always insist that at least two or three of them are books of poetry.
That's great.
Yeah.
You also have another program, Writing by Writers.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think's happening to creative writing now in university?
Well, nothing very good.
Oh. I think it's taken a bad turn.
I do. I mean, a lot of that
from
is
the golden age.
A lot of that is simply about money. You know,
okay.
It's that they're the increasingly privatized university,
mm-hmm.
even the public universities, like my own. Now that they are privatized, they're much more interested in yogurt products and prescription drugs, and much less interested in the arts. And it's tragic. I mean, it's a tragedy what we've watched over the last years. Not simply for the arts, but the price of tuition
mm-hmm,
and.
Mm-hmm.
Cutting out the middle class. I mean, all the things that are happening in the universities are extremely discouraging to me. But even beyond that, even beyond the fact of no money, there's a kind of an insider's club in the university where everything's a little condescending and,
mm-hmm.
well, it's okay to write about nature as long as you write about the degradation of nature. But, you know, if you're
right.
celebrating it anyway, you're kind of passé and naive. And, you know, there's so many ways to be naive in a university writing program. And, you know, I'm tired of, you know, everything being kind of an inside joke inside of an inside joke. And I'm tired of condescension masquerading as intelligence. And so I founded Writing by Writers as an alternative. I don't like when we talk about us and them. I don't like the elitism. You
mm-hmm.
know, writing's for everyone, and it can help everyone. And so, anyway, I founded Writing by Writers with a very good friend, and we are adding a little conference each year. We have our flagship conference in Tomales Bay, which
mm-hmm.
is out on a beautiful bluff overlooking the water, and we just had Kwame Dawes, speaking of poets,
mm-hmm.
and Andre Debuse and Dorothy Allison. Next year we're having Mark Doty and Steve Almond.
He's one of the best workshop.
Yeah. He's fantastic.
Faculty I've ever worked with.
And we have a little conference in Boulder, and we have another little thing called a writer's boot camp where you bring a whole manuscript. So we want to create community where I originally started Tomales Bay, the conference, years ago with UC Davis Money. Because I wanted my graduate students to see that, like, there's a lot of stories and there's a lot of ways to tell them. And, you know, language isn't something that you should use to make other people feel excluded, basically.
Thank you.
And so I started it really strictly so that I could bring my graduate students out to the coast with all these other writers and let them see that there are actual people who read actual books and they go to bookstores and, you know, they might be doctors or plumbers or they might drive buses, but they're still engaged,
right.
you know. And then the university, in its wisdom, cut that program, and so I started my nonprofit to reinvigorate it. And it's going great. We are up to three workshops a year, and
That's
we'll
fantastic.
Probably add another one in 16.
Yes, we can do much more without the elitism
yeah.
that you find often in university and the politics. Thank you for bringing that program, and thank you for coming to our show.
Oh, you're welcome.
You've been listening to Poets Cafe with our very wonderful special guest, Pam Houston. Look for the Poets Cafe fan page on Facebook. You've been listening to Poets Cafe on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond.